and the sky went black. Tales and history of a longbow with Henrik Armstad and Adam Westlund. Welcome to the pod and the sky went black with me, Henrik Armstad, and Adam Westlund. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm quite good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Today we're going to talk about the decline and fall and disappearance of a longbow. A bit of a sad story. One can tell that by when reading the literature, most books about the longbow don't contain almost anything about this. Why is that, you think?
Well, first of all, you could imagine that most of the people writing research and literature about the longbow are interested in the longbow primarily, and automatically or naturally, I would say that this story about the decline of the longbow also includes the ascendance of many other weapons. So you focus away from the longbow when you're talking about the decline of the longbow in certain ways.
That's true, certainly. Anyway, I would like to read a letter here written by a very famous person. It says, "But I still wish with you that pikes could be introduced, and I would add bows and arrows. These were good weapons, not wisely laid aside. First, because a man may shoot as truly with a bow as with a common musket. Secondly, he can discharge 4 arrows in the time of charging and discharging 1 bullet. Thirdly, his object is not taken from his view by the smoke of his own side. Fourthly, a flight of arrows seen coming upon them terrifies and disturbs the enemy." And he also states that bows and arrows are more easily provided everywhere than muskets and ammunition. Now, the exciting thing about this letter is that it was written by a very famous person, Benjamin Franklin. You know Benjamin Franklin?
Absolutely.
Yes. The famous American politician and inventor, most famous for inventing the flash and
at least they claim
thunder.
So, yes.
Yes, exactly, with a key. And also a very famous American politician, and he was involved in writing the Declaration of Independence, wasn't it? In 1776, this is written.
Yeah.
And the longbow has been gone from the European battlefields for several hundred years by then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And still he makes a valid point. Mm-hmm. The longbow is better than the musket, thus presenting us with a puzzle here.
Yeah.
If the longbow was so much better than the musket, the firearms, why did it disappear?
Yeah.
What do you have any comments upon this letter?
Well, he does present a valid point, and I would say that many military historians focusing on the 16th and maybe early 17th centuries have discussed this, and they're all quite puzzled. There are many, many different explanations. And the probable reason for this is that there is no obvious one, because the longbow seems to be so effective still, so why abandon it? So that is probably the reason for the multitude of different explanations that we see in the literature.
And one can even think that all of those explanations put together can make a more plausible argument for the longbow vanishing than one sole argument, sole explanation. Between 1590 and 1600,
yes,
there's a huge debate in England going on.
Yeah.
This is some time after the battles of Crecy and Agincourt.
Quite a lot of time.
There's a lot of things happening. First of all, the medieval period has ended, right?
Yeah, quite a long time ago. The medieval period is, of course, not... No one woke up one day and realized, oh, we're not in the Middle Ages anymore. But usually you put the end of the Middle Ages at the mid-15th century. Some people use the fall of Constantinople in 1453, and others that put it later use the discovery of the Americas in 1492,
right,
as the end of the medieval period. So by 1590, even if you count generously, the medieval period has been gone for 100 years.
So now it's the early modern period.
Absolutely,
which we usually
yes.
call it, the early yeah. modern period. And the early modern period is mostly European phenomenon
yeah.
as such, but there's also things happening. For instance, the territorial states emerge. Yes. You no longer have that kind of medieval governments going on, but you have territorial states, which are defined by borders. And if you live within those borders, you are living in Sweden.
You are a citizen of that
England.
Country, yes.
Exactly. And also there's an expansionist thrust from the central government, right?
Absolutely.
Especially in England and in Sweden and Denmark, for instance.
You can see several examples of this. And kings have tried to expand their power and their range of influence for many hundreds of years. It starts already in the 13th century. But gradually they get the means of doing this. And you mentioned Sweden, England, and
Denmark
as examples. One thing that happens in all of these countries during the 16th century is that the kings create permanent war fleets connected to the countries themselves, rather than, as they did in the medieval period, you used trade ships and you just put soldiers on them, which was far less effective.
Exactly. And also a different kind of armies, right?
Absolutely. You also have standing armies, because you have the need of a permanent army, and therefore you can't use musters and levies that you used before. You need a permanent force and you need to train them effectively, but this also costs a lot more money.
And the more obvious thing from a military history perspective is that those armies increasingly get handguns.
Yes.
Muskets and, how do you pronounce it,
harquebus.
What are those weapons?
Well, the musket is a slightly later weapon and a slightly more effective weapon than the harquebus, but they are both sort of forerunners of the rifle, but they don't have the
rifling.
The rifling of the barrel that you shoot from. They're black powder weapons. They were very imprecise. Especially the harquebus, it was mostly effective on very short ranges, but it had a greater penetrating power than the earlier weapons such as the longbow and the crossbow on short range. It didn't try to actually penetrate, for example, plate armor. It just smashed through it by sheer force of impact, rather than actually trying to create a hole to pierce through, which was a difference. So these weapons have been introduced earlier on. They're quite common already in the 14th century, but they're so they're not very effective during that era. So they become more and more popular, and gradually they start taking over the role of the crossbow in Central Europe and the longbow in Britain. And as you mentioned, the longbow hangs in there because it's a very good weapon, and you get a fierce debate. You have defenders of the longbow that cite all these great victories that England has won based on this weapon system, and
right.
We can't let go of this.
There is some sort of phasing out. Now, we've been reading a scientific paper written by Mr. Thomas Esper, and this is not a new paper. It's quite old. It's from 1965, but we both find it quite good. Quite
yes,
solid.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And he makes some sort of comparison to modern days, where different weapon systems are phased in and phased out, and that this is not always done by sort of rational thought, but there is sort of one weapon system becomes more unfashionable it's kind of embarrassing, and then you're facing our Pentagon officials upon the phasing out of particular weapon systems. He makes a comparison. Seems like a sound, not so anachronistic as one might think, comparison to me.
Yeah, absolutely. But as I mentioned before, there have been so many different explanations for this. So obviously, there is probably a social factor in this, or you have to search for explanations on a structural level, I think. It's very hard to just go to the battlefield and say which one performs better if we shoot at this distance. You have to look at society at large to find the explanations for it.
And there are also other explanations. One problem for providing huge quantities of troops with English longbows is that you need huge quantities of longbows. And then you yes. need a yew tree. Right, yeah, right.
Preferably, at least.
And some scholars have pointed out that the yew tree becomes scarce. There are less and less of it, and that the English state has more and more problems. First of all, apparently, I did not know this, but apparently the yew trees growing in England is not of that good quality due to the problem that the temperature in England changes a lot. Apparently, the wood twists.
Yeah, it becomes crooked. And
the problem with this is the climate in England is too changeable, causing the yew tree to twist while growing.
Mm.
So then you need to import yew tree from Spain if you're the King of England.
Yeah.
Which you actually could do quite easily, even if England was at war with Spain. They kept on importing yew tree, which is slightly...
The power of the market.
The power of money, right. Mm. But eventually even the yew tree of Spain diminished, so that became a problem. Another problem with the longbow is that you need arrows.
Yes.
Okay, the bow itself is quite easy to manufacture because you just take a stick and yeah. bend it. But making arrows, thousands and thousands and thousands of arrows, is cumbersome, right?
Yes, absolutely. You get rid of them very, very quickly as well. And if the arrow isn't completely straight, it won't shoot straight. So it will be completely useless because you're shooting such long distances, so you will miss by a wide margin if the arrow is faulty.
Right. It says here that in 1418, Henry V orders his sheriffs to find him 1.2 million arrows.
Yeah.
1.2 million arrows. You need that if you're going to war. You shoot like 10 or 15 minutes a minute.
Yeah, arrows a minute, yes.
Right?
Mm.
Minutes a minute. 10 or 15 arrows a minute. And you're 7,000 archers. A million arrows isn't that much, actually.
Exactly.
If you do that.
You try to get some of them back after the battle, but many of them will be destroyed and others will be gone for other reasons. So, of course, you need a large supply of arrows.
During the early modern period in the 16th century, there are new military organizational tactics and strategies being invented.
Yes.
Especially in the Netherlands, right?
Yeah. But first, if we give some backstory here.
Right.
First, we have a phase of medieval military history, you could say, between the battles of Crecy and Agincourt, the 100 years between the mid-14th century and the mid-15th century, where sort of infantry almost disappears from the battlefields. You can see that you have distance weapons, like the longbow or the crossbow, combined with cavalry. And the infantry, the melee infantry, is seen as almost completely obsolete. You see diminishing numbers of melee infantry for a long time. But then, especially the Dutch start, and also the Swiss later on, start coming up with new uses of the infantry. New tactics where you form larger squares, where you combine pikes, or in the German case, halberds, with the new black powder weapons. These larger squares have a better resistance to cavalry charges. They're much deeper, so the sheer force of men will hold back the charging cavalry. Also, the pikes and halberds keep the charging riders at a distance, and these effective weapons with newly drilled soldiers who are working permanently as soldiers, many of them are mercenaries, they give the black powder troops time to reload. So we talked about this before, that the speed of the longbow, that you could shoot 5 or 6 arrows in the time when one harquebusier shot one of his shots, that is sort of negated in a way, because you get that time defended by this wall of pikes. So all of these things become fashionable and they spread to England, and the proponents of this new weapon system launch a fierce attack on sort of the people they see as backwards, the ones who don't want to get rid of King Harry's old weapon system from the mid-14th century.
Yeah, there's always a source, well, one of those people call their enemies who are defending the longbow for King, calling him a King Harry captain.
Exactly.
Exactly.
A derogatory term for someone not wanting to adapt to the new time.
Now, this was called the new discipline.
Yes.
Right. So what would... First of all, the 16th century, at least in England,
yes,
not in Sweden, by the way, but in England, it was a very peaceful century compared to other centuries.
Yeah, especially compared to the 14th and 15th centuries.
So now you have the archers, which during the Hundred Years' Wars, the English mount a campaign in France, and they go there, and they fight, and then they come home for a period of time, and then get back again, a new campaign. Oh, no, we're going to attack France again. Yay! And they permanently go to war.
Yes.
Now, that should create some sort of notion among the archers themselves that it's a good thing to practice,
yeah,
to keep the skill up, because I'm soon going to war again.
Yeah.
Telling people to keep on practicing archery wouldn't be that hard.
No.
But if there are no wars, people are still told to go and practice archery all the time because we may need you if there's a war, should be a harder thing to do. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I would say that there's definitely some truth to that, and especially in this era where sort of the coercive powers of the state were not as strong as they are today, it was very hard to force the multitude of the people to anything. I would say that sort of the longbow was kept up, or the knowledge of the longbow, the know-how of the longbow was being kept. It was not because of coercion from the state, it was because it was a culture of the people. And I mean, we could go back a little to the other explanations that we talked about before, because generally people have explained the loss of the longbow, or the traditional, the slightly lazy explanation is, of course, the penetrative power of the new black powder weapons, and that the longbow couldn't match them. But the problem is also that if you dismount knights, then by shooting their horses, then you've still put them out of the battle. So I don't think that explains it all, because you see a trend in the late Middle Ages before the new developments that I talked about recently with the new discipline and so on. Before this, you see a trend of knights dismounting. They became elite infantry in heavy armor instead. And then you can't really shoot the horse. So there you see another one. Then you will have to fire with the new weapons.
The muskets.
Yeah, the muskets primarily. Because the longbow has a hard time when there are no horses to shoot anymore.
So there is a decline in longbow archery in England during the 16th century, which continues the whole century, right? Now, prior to making this podcast today, we've been trying to get some more information about naval archery.
Yes.
Maritime archery in the English Navy. In 1545, Henry VIII's flagship, Mary Rose, sinks in the Solent,
yes,
outside the English coast, and aboard this ship there are huge amounts of longbows,
yeah,
and arrows and so on, and they even find skeletons when excavating the ship of longbow archers, which can be interpreted as professional longbow archers.
Yes.
This could suggest that the use of a longbow was prolonged in the Navy. And that makes some sort of sense, because if you're shooting a musket, you hit things in 20 yards, 25 yards,
yeah,
or something like that, 20 meters.
Mm.
And that's really not good enough if you're on a boat, shooting,
yeah,
at another boat.
You could penetrate at a further range, of course, but you won't hit.
You won't hit anything, and you need to hit it.
Yeah.
So it would make sense to still continue to use longbows where you can actually hit the enemy 200 yards away. And we also found some evidence that longbows were used aboard Scandinavian ships as well, didn't
yes.
we?
We found the remains of a report of an archaeological excavation in a Danish ship outside the coast of the Swedish city Kalmar. And on it, the archaeologists had noted that there were crossbow bolts and also peculiar ash sticks,
yes,
and which he couldn't explain. But to longbow enthusiasts, it's not hard to identify these as...
Those were longbow arrows.
Yeah, as longbow arrows.
Mm-hmm. Which makes perfect sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. Along with a crossbow. Anyway, so maybe in the future when traveling to the Mary Rose Museum, maybe we can make an extra podcast about maritime naval archery.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting. The use of a longbow did continue all through the 16th century in England. For example, the Somerset County Muster for 1584. They were supposed to provide 800 shot and 700 bowmen.
Yes.
And shot, you claim, is...
Yeah, black powder weapons.
Black powder weapons. They're supposed to have 800 musketeers. Do you say musketeers?
Probably, they were probably harquebusiers. Yes. But yeah, harquebusiers. Yeah.
But you know.
But we don't really know. But 800...
D'Artagnan wasn't there. No.
800 men using black powder weapons.
Right. They're supposed to have 800 black powder weapon guys and 700 bowmen. And what did they have? They had 762 shots and almost 1,000 bowmen. Mm. So they had much more bowmen than they were supposed to have and less musketeers.
Yeah, they provided more bowmen than they were asked to provide.
Exactly. So when studying these figures, you can see that some districts or regions that were supposed to provide bowmen did not. They refused.
Especially later on.
Especially. But this is quite late.
Yeah. 1584. This is
1584,
yes. Right. You have an example from London, I think.
Yes. And London in 1572, many were either not practicing archery properly or were not practicing archery at all. You can do other
Hertfordshire
refused to muster archers. And Dorset also said that the harquebus are of better account. We like harquebuses instead of those embarrassing longbows, right? Yeah. So there is mountain opposition towards the longbow.
We also have another reference from 1590 in something called A Brief Discourse on War.
Yeah, this is the debate, right? This is when the debate really starts off.
Yeah.
Sir Roger Williams.
Yeah, an English officer in the Low Countries. And he writes, "In our ancient wars, our enemies used crossbows and such shoots. Few or any at all had the use of longbows as we had. Wherefore, none could compare with us for shot. But God forbid we should try our bows with their muskets and calivers, which is the same as harquebuses, without the like shot to answer them."
Basically, they're scared.
Yeah.
Because they say, okay, if you're opposing crossbowmen, no problem.
Yeah.
We beat them before and we will beat them today. But now they're coming with their black powder weapon. God forbid that we meet them on the battlefield.
He's basically saying you're fighting tanks with cavalry, but,
but was,
in another time period.
But was he right?
Probably not, but it is very hard to say because we have very few references from this time. We have very few detailed accounts of battles fought with the two weapons in the 16th century. But we have a very fierce debate with people thinking and stating a lot of things, and they state completely contrary facts. Someone says that the longbow has a much greater range, and someone says, no, the longbow cannot stand up in range. So they claim things that are completely contrary. Mm-hmm. So some of them seem not to have actually seen the weapons used, but just sort of following this trend that we talked about.
Well, one thing that they seem to agree upon on both sides of the debate, though, is that the 1590s longbowmen are not trained enough.
Exactly.
They can't draw the bow long enough to gain the energy stored in the weapon. Complain that after a period of 3 or 4 months service, only 1/10 of all bowmen were worthwhile, that they couldn't stand the sort of hardships of campaigning.
No. And this also comes to one of the main concepts that we have been talked about, that we have talked about in the previous podcasts, because one of the problems with having the longbowmen as compared to even the crossbows earlier on, was that you needed so much training to be an efficient or proficient longbow archer. And with the new weapons, like the harquebus, you could train soldiers much faster. You wouldn't need this constant training, especially if you didn't have the wars that we talked about before, so that the longbow archers were declining in quality. Then they could not do what they could have done before. So some historians actually mean that the reason why there are so differing views, even among modern scientists or modern historians, about whether a longbow could pierce plate armor is because of this, that they could pierce it when they were at the peak of their efficiency, when the longbow was the favorite weapon of the English, but gradually went more and more out of fashion. It couldn't anymore because they couldn't use it as they did at the height of their skill.
That's one person in involved with this debate. He claims that arrows cannot stop advancing infantry.
Yeah.
He acknowledges the fact that you can stop advancing cavalry with a longbow archer
by shooting
the horses, right?
Yes.
And he quite interested, he says that he's talked to some soldier who had encountered longbows, and that soldier claimed that all you need to do is to tilt your head with your plate armor helmet so that the longbow arrows just bounces off everywhere.
Yeah, even if they hit my body, they just bounce off, the soldier claimed.
This was volley fire, though.
Yes, volley fire. But some of them could hit your body anyway,
yes,
and the body armor would protect you.
Protect you. And we done tests within our organizations, the fraternity of St. George and so on and so forth. It seemed possible to penetrate plate armor at around 20 meters, 20 yards range. But then you're quite close. Don't get that 200, 300 yards effect anymore. In these days where the weapons of fire have been rightly used, it has been scarcely seen that either pike or halberd has come to join at any time before the one party did turn their faces by reason of a terrible force of a great and small shot.
Yeah, this
you don't get close enough.
Yeah, he actually means that longbow battles were bloodier because they could not get rid of the attacking enemies before they reached it. So they were bloodier because there was more melee, while in the new era, one side was usually shot down enough to run away before any actual melee ensued.
So the opponents towards the longbow, they sort of emphasize the point-blank range combat.
Yeah.
In which they claim a superiority of the musket. Thus, not at least because of the bowmen did not pull their bows to the full extent.
Yeah.
Only considering point-blank range. But they also dismiss the greater rapidity of fire of a bowman.
Mm.
This seems a bit stupid to do, even though if you're standing in a big square of thousands of men and you're sort of protected, it should be better to shoot 10 or 15 projectiles a minute than how many?
Two, I would say.
Something like that.
But I think there were ways to sort of slightly alter the advantage of the longbow, because in the new discipline they started developing tactics where you had something called rolling lines, where some people loaded their weapons, went forward to shoot them. The others were charging at the same time, so they took turns charging and loading, which raised the speed of the shooting, and you could always provide what he said. You can stop a charge, because if everyone fires at the same time, you have this devastating effect on point-blank range. But, of course, absolutely. I think that this is one of the harder things to explain, because even many of the people arguing against the longbow say that, sure, the longbow fires very quickly, but this and that and so forth. So this is one of the harder things to explain away by the opponents of the longbow.
The people defending the longbow, then, they use different arguments.
Yes.
One of the interesting pamphlets, they all produce pamphlets, by the way, all the time. A brief treatise to prove the necessity and excellence of the use of archery was published in the 1590s, I suppose. And this 22-page booklet was sponsored by the Boyers and Fletcher's companies of London.
Yeah.
So here we see lobbyism.
Yeah, in the early modern period.
In the early modern period.
Yeah.
So they don't publish the pamphlet themselves, but they pay for it. But this was a real concern concerning the longbow from the government as well.
Yeah.
Abolishing the longbow would create unemployment.
Yeah, many people claim that. And you can see this in this debate. Most of the people defending the longbow say, but what about all the Boyers and Fletchers? What will they do?
What would we do? It's a valid question, right? Another supporter of a longbow was Sir John Smythe, whose booklet appeared in 1590. And he criticized, he said that you people who are opposing the longbow, you don't have any military experience, or not at least any valid military experience, because you've been experiencing civil wars in the Low Countries, or in France, the Netherlands, Holland.
Yeah.
And those wars were strange because they were disorderly and unusual in the lack of discipline.
Yeah, like he claims. Yeah.
He says that those were small civil wars, lacking the true organization necessities of a proper war, which is supposed to be a huge war towards the Spanish Empire or France for that matter.
Yeah.
Does he have a point?
Maybe, because I would say that the longbow reaches its peak of efficiency when used en masse. So when you see the 6,000 or 7,000 longbow archers win the day in the great battles of the Hundred Years' War, you see the enormous volleys falling at the same time, and, as he says, disorderly battles with smaller skirmishing troops, then you wouldn't get the same effect out of the weapon.
Seems a valid point to me.
And probably also the troops would get closer to one another if you're skirmishing. You don't face each other marching against each other on a field. You face each other in villages, in little forests, and things like that. And then you suddenly have the range to fire a gunpowder weapon, for example, on an opposing enemy.
Right. And Smythe also underlines that the firearms are not accurate as for long. You can't hit, which is an argument that we heard before.
Even if the harquebuses and muskets could reach quite far, they were so inexact that they didn't have an effective range that was long enough. So you had to wait for the enemy to advance very close to you. We have this very common saying of the 17th century, wait until you see the whites of the enemy's eye.
Exactly.
That is quoted from many different countries.
Yes.
And then the enemy is quite close.
And there's also talk of the a bow shot as a measure of distance.
Exactly.
And that is 400 yards,
yes,
apparently. So white of the enemy's eyes, 15 yards.
Something like
a
that.
A bow shot, 400 yards.
Yeah.
It's not a small difference. I question myself that you can actually shoot effectively at 400 yards, but say 300.
Yeah.
Now, in 1596, an anonymous author called R.S. Also published a pamphlet defending the longbow.
Mm.
And the usual arguments, cheapness, greater danger, rate of fire. Now, they don't seem to test...
No.
You could imagine that the state of England says, okay, let's put on 10 musketeers or 10 harquebusiers on one side and then 10 longbowmen on the other side, and then you make a test.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is anachronistic of me to propose such a thing. Or is it? They weren't stupid.
Of course they weren't stupid, but I think this sort of approach to things, this sort of scientific approach to things where you test them out in a constrained environment before applying them for real on the field, is something that is coming gradually later on. You have more of these experiments in the Prussian army, for example, in the 18th century, where they try out the effectiveness of a group shooting a musket. They tried out on the practice range, and they tried out in actual battles, and they compare the efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But we have very few examples of this from before the 18th century.
But still, you know, this is the age of this scientific discoveries, where we use scientific methods. The Earth isn't in the center of the universe.
Yeah.
The sun doesn't revolve. You have Galileo, Galileo.
Yeah.
And Newton is right around the corner.
Yeah.
In the 17th century. And to some extent, there's a rational thought that it starts to form. So I wouldn't say that it would have been impossible.
No, maybe it wouldn't have been impossible, but you also need the institutionalization of science, where you sort of you take science from the few geniuses working on their own or sort of spreading their pamphlets, and you put it into the institutions of the state. The state has to be permeated by this approach to things, and I think that that probably comes gradually, because in the 17th century you see sort of the start of slightly more modern taxing systems and things like that. So you many of the things we associate with the modern world just starting there in their very at their very beginning.
That's right.
This time.
Another argument was made was that the firearms were much more expensive than a longbow.
Mm-hmm.
And when eventually the firearms succeed the longbow in the English army, one can see that the cost of equipping a company went up by 50%.
Yeah.
50% more expensive to equip a company of soldiers. And that was quite bad because England wasn't a very rich state. It was quite poor state compared to the rich state of Denmark, for instance,
yeah.
which had the tolls of the Baltic Sea and everything.
Yeah.
It's a bit strange that wasn't a better argument. So.
Absolutely. But I think that sometimes it might have been hard to sort of... We have all the development to look at now, and I think maybe you wouldn't look 50 years back and compare the prices of equipping a company. You would rather just say, what weapons do we need to be successful on the battlefield? And then you would pay that cost. I think since this change was so gradual, I think it was very hard. You didn't switch out the longbows for gun and black powder weapons from one day to the next, because then you would see, whoa, how expensive everything became. So I think that the graduality of this development is sort of hides this. But as you look at it from a modern perspective, you can see much more clearly how costs were rising.
One must also remember that this debate that was being conducted in England in the late 16th century was conducted by the military elites and also high nobility and
yeah.
even royalty. And they all agreed upon the imperfection of the peasantry,
yeah.
Of the lower classes, the actual longbowmen. And they tried to prohibit the gambling, playing cards, football,
yeah.
which was quite early. They
this started in the 14th century already.
Right, but now, Pomerantianism says that praised bygone days when men would go into the fields and practice archery for exercise, but now we have taken up whoring in towns instead of shooting in fields, which is quite... And also... When Queen Elizabeth I came into power, she expressed the same thoughts in 1591. The state's interest in the maintenance of archery were clearly indicated. Whereas Her Majesty is informed that diverse unlawful games are daily used in most places of his realm, and that thereby archery is greatly decayed. We should take special care that such kinds of exercises, games and pastimes are as prohibited by law, namely bowls, dicing, carding and such like, may be forthwith forbidden, but that instead thereof archery may be revived.
Yes.
And this is 1591.
Yeah.
4 years later, the longbow disappears from the English army, basically, as an organized poor peasants. They were giving all the blame from the elites.
Yeah, and there are theories about the disappearance of the longbow that also have to do with class perspective, where people claim that for the ruling classes, it was very convenient to phase out the longbow that could be constructed and used very well by the lower classes without, and the tradition was being kept alive among the lower classes. While with the new weapon systems that needed black powder to work or to function, you needed to be in control of the the import or the trade with black powder to be able to equip your armies. And one theory is that sort of on a structural level, of course, there was no mastermind sitting planning all of this, but on a structural level, it was very convenient for the ruling classes to make sure that the weapon that the lower classes could arm themselves with without the help of their betters, so to speak, was made
obsolete
and not...
Now you're being Marxist.
Yeah, that is definitely a Marxist theory, yes. Line of theory. But since we've presented many different views here,
right.
you could claim that there might be an aspect of this that is true.
I'm not at ease with that theory because of a crossbow. Now, all over Europe during the 16th century, this is a part of a central power expanding its reach. You see peasant uprisings, which are quite huge. Henry VIII experiences this. There are quite a few Henry VIII all across Europe.
Yeah.
We have in Sweden our own Henry VIII in Gustav Vasa, Gustavus I, and he experiences the exact same thing. Expanding government, which means raising taxes.
Peasant uprisings.
Large peasant uprising, the Dacke Rebellion in Sweden, which was huge.
Yeah.
And really threatened the central government. And they use crossbows.
Yes.
Which are easier for peasants to use since you don't need as much training.
Absolutely. I think that the key here is, though, that you have different traditions in different countries. The longbow was the people's weapon in England, while the crossbow was much more common in most other countries. So I would say that sort of the crossbow and the longbow might have faced the same competition from black powder roughly at the same time. And you have, as you said, during the entire 16th century, most Swedish peasants owned hunting crossbows, which were very easy to just take down from the wall when you needed to start an uprising
today.
Yeah, exactly. When you need to start an uprising against the expanding power of the monarchy.
We have the disappearance of the longbow in 1595. As sort of large-scale weapons, but it continues to exist in warfare in England after that. And there are also new thoughts and new ideas in 1625, which is quite famous, actually, well known. King Charles I. There is an idea about the doubled-armed man, which is a combination of a pike and the longbow.
Yeah,
and this idea. It had some success, some modest success, to use the bow and pike together in military discipline.
Yeah, we should note, though, that it had success mostly theoretically. Many people were enthusiastic about this, but we basically don't see any use on the battlefield that we know of, at least.
There's circumstantial evidence for use of the coupled weapons, if not in actual battle, then in warlike context. English longbow continued to exist inside the heads of military theorists,
yes,
even in the 17th century. And also one must not forget the colonial wars.
Yeah.
In 1622, 400 longbows and 800 sheaves of arrows were sent to America from England to help rearm Virginian colonists after a massacre by Indians or Native Americans, which is understandable. These guys over there, they need weapons, and we can't send them expensive muskets because that's expensive. Let's send them longbows.
Yeah.
And they did. And one of the last occasions on which the longbow was used was in 1627 and 1628. Succor the Protestant inhabitants of La Rochelle. So it continues to exist,
yeah,
right?
I think the last recorded use of the longbow on English ground is from 1642, while we have much later, actually, Scottish evidence. I think 1688 is the very last.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Home guard duties. That's another thing. Dad's army. But 17th century style.
Yeah.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler? But 17th century, home guard. Which is a sound idea. We need equipment for all those thousands and thousands of soldiers. 300 longbows in London as compared to 3,000 muskets, but still.
And you can once again see the connection to the people with the Home Guard, the people's weapon, even though, so because the Home Guard is not sort of the core of England's military at this time. So this weapon continues to exist in the more backwards circumstances, where you maybe you won't have the possibilities to equip everyone with black powder weapons, and you might still have sort of an ongoing culture, an ongoing tradition of using the longbow among the people joining the Home Guard.
And also being used as a personal weapon.
Yeah.
Now you're a soldier, Mr. Common Englishman, and you're going to war, and you bring the longbow as a personal weapon, which is the most famous example from the 20th century is Mad Jack Churchill, right?
Yeah, from the Second World War.
Exactly, who brought an English longbow to Normandy.
Yeah, and he's the last soldier recorded to have killed an enemy in battle with a longbow.
Oh, I did not know.
Yeah, he killed one or two, I don't remember, German soldiers with the longbow.
Well done, Jack. Now, the bow seems to have been carried out as a personal weapon for a long time. And then you have the Scottish longbow coming at the end of the 17th century.
Yes.
And the Scottish longbow is quite interesting because it's sort of a recurve shape.
Yeah.
Which is supposed to be more effective, I guess.
We don't really know, but you sort of combine, since recurve is something that gives you greater strength or power in other bows. It's probably some sort of combination between two different bow styles.
And you also see ideas about using the English longbow as a method of delivering messages.
Mm-hmm.
You tie some sort of paper.
A scroll or
scroll
something, yeah.
Paper, so, which is a good thing in Robin Hood movies as well.
Yeah.
That's the way you deliver the message to Prince John. That's
and they all always hit the middle of the wooden door.
Yes, and it says, twang, like that.
And somebody's always standing in front of that wooden door.
And here we see a drawing of an archer shooting fire shafts in 1628. Some sort of quite advanced grenade there, stuck to the longbow. And, quoting, "The Scottish war bow was also employed in a great clan battle that took place in 1688 at Mulroy in Lochaber between the MacDonalds of Keppoch and the MacIntoshes of Moy."
Now all the Scots will be calling in to to butcher your pronunciation, I'm sure. I don't know how they're pronounced, but it's tricky with the Gaelic names.
Thank you for destroying that dramatic ending here. Anyway, between the MacDonalds and the MacIntoshes. And this is considered by many to be the last use of a longbow in organized warfare. 1688, the Battle of Mulroy, which makes me kind of sad.
It is also quite interesting, I think, because the Scots during the peak of the English longbow, the battles between England and Scotland always seem to play out with mostly infantry on the Scottish side, without many bows. So the Scots sort of catch on to this very, very late when the English are already abandoning it. So it's quite an interesting. I wonder if it's sort of that worked for them. I don't know. No, it's
but it is an
tell.
Irony of history that the Scots were the last ones to use the English longbow in a major battle.
Yeah,
the Battle of 1688 at Mulroy. At the same time as the longbow really vanishes, then
yes,
it rises as a recreational weapon.
Yes.
Which is one of the themes of our next podcast,
yeah.
Right? Yes, right. But still, some people say, going back to Benjamin Franklin,
yeah,
in the late 18th century,
yeah,
and also some people claiming that had Napoleon had English longbows at Waterloo in 1805,
yes,
wasn't it? Yes, right, he would have won.
1815.
Sorry, I thought speaking of the Battle of Trafalgar. Sorry, Mr. Nelson, Admiral Nelson, I mixed it up. 1850, right. Is there any sound thought behind this reasoning that Napoleon actually could have benefited from the English longbow?
In a way, I think it might be true. Because, as you say, military historians have proposed that sort of a company of medieval English longbowmen could have outdone the musketeers in Waterloo quite heavily. And I think that we have to think of it as sort of this, that would have been completely foreign to the warfare that was being conducted in the early 19th century. So you would introduce a completely new element to it. You could have fired from afar, and I definitely think that sort of with enough arrows, a medieval company of longbowmen could have been very effective.
Brian of our dear friend Brian of a Fraternity of St. George, he well said that still there is no infantry weapon which has the flexibility of a longbow, being able both to do volley fire, for example, over some wooden landscape or a hill or something like that, and direct fire.
Yes.
Directly towards it. There are some automatic rifles which combine a sort of grenade launcher, some leaf rifling. And sort of, but it's cumbersome and not as easy as using the longbow.
The longbow, you just change the angle of your shot, likely.
And there you go. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk. And thank you, dear listener, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye bye. And the sky went black. Tales and history of a longbow with Henrik Arnstad and Adam Westlund.